Hi, welcome to Visual Studio Toolbox. I'm Robert Green, your host, and today we're going to talk about Entity Framework. And I have Diego Vega and Rowan Miller with me. So guys, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Introduce yourselves, and then we'll set up the issue, and we're going to be demo heavy. So we've got a whole bunch to cover. This is going to be great stuff.
Okay. Hello, I'm Diego. I'm a program manager in the Entity Framework team.
And I'm Rowan Miller. I'm also a program manager on the Entity Framework team.
Okay, so guys, I think what we want to cover is Entity Framework's been out for a while, so we'll do the high-level overview of what is it. Then I want to talk about the various versions, because there was versions that have shipped with Visual Studio, particularly there was a version that shipped in the box in 2010, but it's not like you guys have gone to the dark recesses and worked on the next version, which is going to magically appear when the next box ships. There have been a number of updates since, so I kind of wanted to take an opportunity to get everybody up to speed on what was in the framework when it shipped in 2010, what kind of stuff you've been doing since that can be done today, show some demos of that, where do people get it, and then, of course, we'll talk about what's coming in the next version.
Sounds good.
Sound good?
Yep.
I think we'll take two episodes, so this will be part one. We're at the moment not quite sure where we're going to cut off. We'll look at the time and then... when we're done with part one, we'll just say, okay, that's enough for today, then we'll come back next time and do the part two.
That sounds good.
Okay. So the first thing is just to refresh everybody's memory, what is the Entity Framework, why was it invented, why should I use it, and what's wrong with the way we grizzled old vets used to do data access?
Okay, so Entity Framework is Microsoft's answer to the object relational mapper problem, and that is, I have a database which has my data all stored in relational tables. Tables, columns, foreign key constraints between those. When I write an application, I want to write an application in terms of classes. So I have classes that have properties on them, and then classes can reference other classes in either reference properties or collections. And the problem is I need to be able to map between those two. Mm-hmm. And traditionally, developers would write a lot of code to do translation between the results of a SQL query and hydrating those results into a set of objects. Entity Framework and other ORMs solve that problem by defining the mapping between them once, and then the Entity Framework takes care of doing the translation from queries written in terms of your objects to translate it into SQL to send to the database, then takes those results and hydrates them back into classes for you to work with in your application. And then at the same time, when you manipulate those objects, so you might update a property on one of those objects, Entity Framework takes care of translating in that changes into insert, update, and delete statements that are sent to the database.
Right. So basically, it's a wrapper around the type of plumbing that you could write yourself.
Absolutely.
To go from this database, you send SQL statements up, we all know how to do that, you get results back, so you could write the code yourself to translate between the database or your object model, your classes, or you could say, why am I doing this work? Shouldn't Microsoft provide that for me as part of the product?
Absolutely.
And the answer is, and that's what the Entity Framework is. It's a feature of the framework. There's obviously Visual Studio tooling in it, right? But it's a framework feature. So people using anything from Express on up can take full advantage of it?
That's correct, yeah.
Awesome. Okay. So bring us up to speed on what shipped in 2010 and what's been done since.
Okay, so I think we're going to kick off by taking a look through the set of versions that we've actually shipped of the product. So these are things that are out, fully supported, RTM'd. And then a little later we'll talk about some of the things that are up and coming, some previews we have out and what's coming up in the near future.
Okay.
So the first version of EF, which was just called EF at the time, but now we refer to it as EF1, shipped as part of .NET Framework 3.5 Service Pack 1. And the tooling side of it was in Visual Studio 2008. And this was our first release of the product, and it had our database-first workflow. And we'll talk a little bit more about the workflows later on, but database-first is essentially, I have a database, I reverse engineer a model off it, and then I perform data access against that model. This first version had basic ORM support too. So we're talking about the real core functionality that most ORMs have, and the community felt that it lacked a bit of things. So this was a little bit slow to take off. There were a bunch of features that people thought EF really needed to add before it could be used as a serious ORM.
Right. There was a lot of discussion about what's in Entity Framework versus the things that people were using before that, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So Entity Framework wasn't necessarily the first ORM ever invented.
Absolutely not. And there were a lot of features that are present in those other ORMs that people thought we really needed to be taken seriously. Mm-hmm. So that brings us to EF4. So EF4 shipped as part of .NET 4 and Visual Studio 2010. Now, our numbering version has confused people a lot in the past. We called this .NET 4, or EF4, because it shipped with .NET 4.
Right.
We've done some work, and we'll talk about this as we get to talking about the later releases, to try and rationalize the way we version our releases.
Well, Workflow did the same thing. Windows Workflow, right?
Started. Yeah.
They jumped straight to 4.
A lot of products have done this, and there's been a push to swap to something called semantic versioning, which we'll talk about a little later on, which makes it a little bit easier to understand where the different versions fit and what are the changes between them.
Okay.
So like I said, Visual Studio 2010 and .NET 4, and this release of EF added a lot of the features that people thought we needed to be taken seriously. So model-first workflow, which means I don't have to have a database to start with. I can still have a database, but if I don't, I can design my model in a designer with boxes and lines, and then my database can be built for me from that model. One of the key features also was POCO support. Up until now, the classes that you worked with in your application had to derive from something called an entity object, and EF was very restrictive about the shape of those classes. Now, classes are something people are really passionate about. They want their domain classes to be very clean. They want to control them completely. And this is known as POCO, plain old CLR object. So EF4 introduced support for that. You could write your own classes, and EF could work with those. A couple of other notable features, lazy loading, which means it can fetch data for you kind of magically in the background as you request the data. So you might be looking at a blog object. You want all the posts. Instead of having to explicitly run a query to load the posts, Entity Framework is capable of loading those lazily for you.
Right, or order details. You want a list of orders, but I don't want to bring down all the details until I want to look at them.
Absolutely. Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The other important feature we added here was customizable code gen. So when you build your model in Visual Studio, you're using boxes and lines on a design surface. And that designer sits on top of an XML file. The code then gets generated from that XML file. Mm-hmm. So you might have a blog and a post class or orders and order lines in your model. The code generation will generate an order and an order line class for you, or a blog and a post class, as well as a context, which is the thing you use to interact with Entity Framework. And you'll see that in action a bit later. What we introduced was the way to customize the code that gets generated. So we have the default code that gets generated. Mm-hmm. But say you wanted to generate POCO classes, well, we shipped an extra template that you can plug in, which customizes the code generation, so you get POCO classes instead of our default classes.
Hmm. Okay. So do you have good data on when on there? So there are three ways: database first, model first, and then the POCO support. Is that the same thing as code first, essentially?
No, code first comes in a little bit later. Code first makes heavy use of POCO support.
Okay. So
yeah, in Photo, you need to create your model in an XML file and also write your classes. It wasn't that easy. Code first makes it easy.
So I'll ask this question in a second.
Okay. So let's jump into the next release. So at this point, we had some features on the back burner. So we had code first, and we had some other features we were working on. And we really didn't want to wait for the next release of the .NET framework to get these into customers' hands.
Right.
So we entered the bold new world of shipping as a standalone release outside of the .NET framework. EF4.1 was available in two places. You could go to Microsoft Download Center, and you could download a standalone installer that would put EF4.1 on your machine. We also decided to ship via NuGet. And NuGet is released by Microsoft, and it's a sort of package management solution. So you're inside Visual Studio, and you can pull down the pieces that you need for the project you're currently working on. Mm-hmm. NuGet was kind of new at this stage, but we saw NuGet really take off. And we'll talk a little bit later how we're only planning to ship via NuGet now. This release built on top of the components we had in .NET 4. So it's important to realize we didn't take everything that was inside the .NET framework and pull it out and ship it standalone. We're shipping a shim that sits on top of the existing components that are already in .NET 4.
Okay.
Two things we added in this release. The code first workflow. So not everyone wants to work with an XML file in a designer, right? Some people just want to write code. So we introduced the code-first workflow, which you're going to see in action when we do some demos later on. The other thing we heard is that the EF API, which is primarily object context, which is our sort of core object, was was a very complex API. Mm-hmm. Lots of methods, complicated signatures, names you didn't expect, parameters you didn't expect to have to pass to methods. So we took the opportunity to build a wrapper over object context. So this isn't a new context. This is like a facade over the existing components that exposes all the stuff you need to do, the really common tasks to get up and running, writing an application. When you need that extra complexity, then it is in object context. Object context is available under the covers, mm-hmm. so you can drop to it when you need to. EF4.1, people really like this. It took off, so it got nicknamed the Magic Unicorn Edition. So you may hear it referred to as that.
Did the product team come up with that, or did the
we actually didn't. Scott Hanselman came up with that.
Scott Hanselman, okay.
We vigorously embraced it, though. You might have noticed my desktop on my computer is the EF Magic Unicorn.
Awesome. There it is.
Okay, so there's one more release after EF4.1. We recently released EF4.2. Now, there wasn't a whole lot in EF4.2. Some bug fixes for bugs that people were hitting. We also released some components to support how migrations work. So these are kind of frameworky components that we added in to the code we were releasing. And you'll see those in action. So we'll talk about migrations a little bit later on. And I think we're actually going to give you a demo in the second part of this series.
Okay, so database first and model first ship in the Visual Studio 2010.
Correct.
Box. I always do quotes around box because there's no such thing as boxes.
The virtual box.
Yeah. Yes. But in the RTM version of Visual Studio 2010, you got model first and database first.
That's correct.
So take an existing SQL database, create a model from it, or additional ones if there are entity framework providers for that. Take an existing database, create the models mm-hmm. from it, or start with an empty designer, create your model, and then generate the database.
Yep.
That was in 2010. Then 4.1 adds the ability to just write your classes first and mm-hmm. generate the model and the database out of that, correct?
Correct, yeah. And something else we'll talk about later too, code first is, I guess it gives its biggest wow factor when you write your classes first and then generate the database, mm-hmm. but you can also map to an existing database using code first. If you're not an XML guy or a designer guy, you can mm-hmm. use code to map to an existing database.
Okay. So I guess, you know, because I've been writing database apps since before Entity Framework existed, I'm used to starting from the database. Mm-hmm. Right? I want to manage some data. The first thing I do is I create my database.
Absolutely.
But now that I have the choice, I could create the database first if I'm used to that. But if I'm not necessarily used to that, I could just create the classes first and then generate the database on the back end. And then if there's additional stuff that needs to be done in SQL Server, I could just pop into the Management Studio or have my DBA create additional things, the indexes and all the rest of that stuff that is more database specific, right?
Absolutely, yeah. And we'll see the second part of this series, we'll see migrations work, which means you can take some of those things you want to do that aren't natively supported in code first, like creating indexes is mm-hmm. a great example. And you can actually do them still based in code, but at a layer kind of below that's a little bit more database-oriented.
Okay. So is there any reason to think that... Is there any reason to think that model first or code first is for smaller databases, smaller projects, but if you're going to do real work, enterprise class real work, then you got to start with the database? Is there any reason... Would there be any truth to that, if that's what...
Not really. So under the covers, they all use the same runtime. So the performance, all those sorts of things are going to be exactly the same, whether mm-hmm. you use code first, model first, or database first. We'll talk about the reasons why you might choose one over the other, but realistically, you should be able to use any approach to target any size database.
And
We hear actually that a lot, and I think it's mostly a matter of taste and how people are used to work. Mm-hmm. And you shouldn't need to change the way you like working just because you're using EF.
Right.
And that's what we try to do.
Okay.
So the other important thing to call out here, we talked about EF4.1. A lot of people will confuse this as just being code first, but there's actually two very distinct components. Code first, which is the code-based way of working. There's also the DB context API, which is very integrated with code first, but also applies to model first and database first. So the question sometimes come up, is code first the way of the future? Are you guys getting rid of model and database first? And the answer is no. There's three different mm-hmm. options to work with Entity Framework, and all three are perfectly valid. We have a lot of customers in each of those segments using all three of them.
And do your link queries look exactly the same regardless of which workflow you use?
That's correct, yes. The API surface, your classes, and the context, the API surface is exactly the same no matter which approach you take.
Cool.
All right. So the other important thing to call with EF 4.2, NuGet became incredibly popular. In fact, the Entity Framework package quickly became the most downloaded package on NuGet and has stayed there since it was released. So EF 4.2 is actually only available on NuGet now. There's a couple of reasons for doing this. One of it makes it easier for folks to get the latest version straight from Visual Studio. It also makes it easier for us to release updates incrementally. We can get things out a lot faster. It's a lot lighter weight model for releasing our framework.
You're not going to miss going through the download manager and getting stuff in MSDN downloads?
Maybe. We have had some people do find it a little frustrating at the moment. It looks like that frustration is going to wear off as people get used to this new world of downloading stuff via NuGet. Okay. But no, we're not going to miss it at all.
Cool.
There is another reason, actually, that I would like to mention, that the installer that we had for 4.1 installs the Entity Framework DLL in the GAC. And that's something that may confuse a little bit versioning. Like if you have EF 4.1 and EF 4.1 update in the same machine, you are never sure which version you are using. Depends on which one is in the GAC. By getting out of the GAC, we are also simplifying versioning.
Ah.
You always get the version that you have in your project, basically.
Yeah. Okay.
It also removes the need to install it on the machine that you deploy to. So if you write a web application, you have EF 4.1 installed on your machine, and then you deploy to a web server, that web server also needs EF 4.1 installed. If you use NuGet, the required assemblies go up with your application, so there's no need to change anything on the server.
Okay, great. And that's, you said moving forward, that'll be the way that you do updates.
Yeah, we're planning to do all our releases this way now.
Okay.
So then a couple of things that you'll see a little bit later on, sort of what's in the future coming up. So we've had our migrations work, which we've released separately. We're now taking that work and rolling it into EF proper. So we're going to release Entity Framework 4.3. That's going to be basically adding code-first migrations to the Entity Framework package.
Okay.
We'll have a beta for that out shortly. It may even be out by the time this video gets up. And then the RTM for that, we have a short period, take bug fixes and everything, and then we'll get the final release of EF 4.3 out later this year.
And so 4.1, 4.2, actually, let's back up. So what's in Visual Studio 11? If I get the Visual Studio 11 developer preview, what version do I have? Do I have Entity Framework 4.5?
Okay, so we're trying to simplify the way we do releases at the moment, but we do still have this kind of split model where we have some pieces that live inside the .NET framework and some pieces that live outside. So 4.1 and 4.2, we're just talking about the bits that release outside the framework. Going forward, we are updating some of the core pieces in the .NET framework. So when you get the next version of the .NET framework, you'll get, say, enum support and things like that into the core components of Entity Framework.
Okay.
At the same time that releases, we will release a new Entity Framework package on NuGet. And this is what we'll typically refer to as Entity Framework. So the NuGet package is Entity Framework. It makes use of some core components that are inside the .NET framework as well.
And so if I have 2010, let's say Visual Studio 11 has shipped.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got the new core 4.5. And then the next release that comes out on NuGet, which has some cool new feature, will that target 4.5 and therefore won't be usable from 2010?
That's correct.
So the out-of-band updates for 2010 will stop once 11 is shipped?
So we're actually still working out our story around this. It's definite. The next version to get the new features that we're releasing will require the .NET Framework 4.5.
Okay.
And that's purely because we're going to add things like enum support to the API surface of code first, and enum support is in .NET 4.5.
Right.
I'd like to emphasize something that Rowan mentioned before, that is, everything that we are releasing in NuGet, like out of the box, those are shims that are built completely on top of the public API that we release in EF4.0.
Okay.
And like every time we need to add a feature that requires changes to the core bits that are part of the .NET framework, we need to update the .NET framework.
Right.
And like we usually ship a new version of the NuGet package and people understandably are asking for enums to be there, and we cannot ship them as part of NuGet. We actually need to make changes to .NET in order to get those updates. So we are asking for a little bit of patience on that. It's going to be part of 4.5.
Yeah, and that is something
.NET 4.5.
that is something we're looking at addressing too. We're thinking, like, how can we take more and more of the components that are in .NET and try and get that functionality out into our NuGet package so we can make bigger changes in our out-of-band releases.
So the more you get out of the framework, the more you'd be able to write something and say, this is what's in the Entity Framework, and you could use it in 2010 as well as 11, and so eventually
you can,
12, right?
Yep. I mean, use it backwards as well as we can update it quicker. So at the moment, we're on about a 2 or 3 month release cadence with our releases, which is obviously a lot faster than we were out to ship in the .NET framework.
Right. Now, the Visual Studio 11 developer preview, what version of the framework does that have at the moment?
The developer preview actually contains the same bits that we ship in .NET 4.0.
Okay.
So we didn't update what we had as part of .NET on time for it to be included in the preview.
But presumably in beta.
Yeah, the next preview version of Dev 11. Oops, sorry, I shouldn't say that. The next version of Visual Studio 11 should actually include like the updates that we did for that version of .NET, and so that's going to be mostly enum support, support for special types, some improvements for store procedures, and I don't remember.
A whole bunch of bug fixes as well.
Oh, and lots of performance improvements, actually. Yeah.
So I'd love to, we'll have you back after that at some point, and you can show us that stuff.
Sounds good.
All right, but back to the present.
Okay, so I think we're ready to sort of dive into some demos and look at how things work. So I find, I said before, a lot of people get confused, like, I've got all these different options, why would I use one over the other? On this slide, I'm just going to, it's very quick, just want to walk you through how you decide which approach is right for you.
Excellent.
And there's basically two decisions. One is completely out of your hands. It's, am I targeting a new database, or am I targeting an existing database with my app? The next decision is actually completely up to you, and that is, would I rather work in a designer? Like, am I a boxes and lines person who likes to draw things? Or am I code-centric? Like, I want to write code for everything. If I want to say that this class maps to this table or this property maps to this column, I want to write code to do that. So let's go in and fill in some of the boxes now. So new database, designer-centric, you want model first. Here you draw your boxes and lines, and then you generate the database from the designer.
Right.
If you have an existing database and you want to use the designer, you want database first. That is, I reverse engineer the model from the database, and then once I have the model loaded into the designer, I can tweak the way the mapping is, I can change what my classes and properties look like.
Right.
Next box, code first, is really good if you want to write code and then have a database generated for you. And don't get scared by that, it's not like a database that you have no control over. We can do that for you, we can generate something by default, but you have a lot of control over the shape of that database. The last box is a little bit confusing. So if you want to write code, but you want to target an existing database, that's actually also called code first. And it's called code first because it's actually the same. You define your classes and your mapping and everything in code, but then instead of code first generating the database for you, you've actually just pointed at an existing database, and it will use your mapping to try and read and write from that database.
So that assumes that the structure of your classes maps to the database, right? Because so obviously, if it's an existing database and there's a conflict, your code loses, right?
That's correct, yes.
Hopefully.
So we have this mapping code. So you write your classes. There's also the ability to either add attributes or write separate code that tells Entity Framework how your classes map to your database.
Okay.
And that's useful not just when targeting an existing database, but you might not like the schema we generate by default. So you use that mapping to influence the schema that we generate.
Okay.
That said, it can be really confusing trying to write a lot of classes to map to a big database. So in preview at the moment, we have a set of power tools, and one of the functionality that's available in those power tools is the ability to take an existing database and actually reverse engineer a kind of starting point code first model. So it'll generate your classes and the mapping to the database for you.
Right. And do all of these, one of the things that any framework offered over, say, Linked to SQL, was the ability to create a model based on multiple databases, right? So Linked to SQL assumed you had all of your data in a database, but this Entity Framework object model could be drawing from multiple databases?
Entity Framework itself actually just targets one database at the moment. That is a pretty common request we get. The biggest thing in Entity Framework is the sort of mapping engine that allows you to do some really complex mapping. So where we're talking about your classes and your tables don't align, that's where Entity Framework is really powerful when you have to do complicated mapping.
The other thing that Entity Framework supports that Linked to SQL doesn't is multiple types of databases. Like you can have like the same model pointing to a SQL Server database, or you can have your same model pointing to something that is not SQL Server.
Okay.
But not like pointing to two databases at the same time.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
All right. So with that said, I think we're ready to go ahead and look at some of these boxes. I think we'll start with code first. That's probably the newest and the most exciting. So we're going to start with this box on the top right, which is new database, and I want to write code.
Okay.
So to look at that, I'm going to jump into Visual Studio. When we're working here, remember, we're going to use EF4.2, which is only available on NuGet. Before we jump into actually writing code, I just want to take a look at the Data Developer Center. So this is msdn.com/data/EF. This will get you up and running with a whole bunch of videos and tutorials for Entity Framework 4.1 and 4.2, as well as our previous versions as well. Mm-hmm. You'll notice there's Entity Framework 4.1 a lot on here, and we're still in the process of updating the content on here. So under the Get It box, here you'll see a link to where you can download that standalone installer for Entity Framework 4.1.
Okay.
But remember, 4.2 is only available on NuGet, so you actually don't need to download and install anything.
Right.
So coming over to Visual Studio, I'm just going to work in a console app because that kind of takes everything else out of the picture and you can see how code first behaves. So we'll call this, I think I'm up to demo 4 now. And you really don't want to watch me type a lot of stuff, so I've got some snippets I'm going to use. So we're going to start by writing our classes. These classes have no dependencies on Entity Framework at all, right?
Right.
And this is what we mean by POCO. This is a class. This is what you'd write if you were writing a class. You can see here I've got a blog, and we'll look at padding this model out a little bit more in the future. Now that I've got my domain class, I want to be able to use this to interact with the database. And this is where Entity Framework comes into the picture. So there's two options for installing a NuGet package. I can do right-click Manage NuGet References.
Now this assumes that you've got the NuGet extension installed.
That's correct. Right, so NuGet's actually an extension for Visual Studio. You can get it on the VS Gallery or through Extension Manager within Visual Studio.
Okay.
The other way I can install NuGet packages is via the Package Manager console. This gives me like a command line experience for installing packages. So we're going to use install package, and the EF package is called Entity Framework. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to go ahead and install that.
And then that goes out to the NuGet site, downloads things, sets the references.
Yeah. So really the only thing it's done in our Entity Framework package is download the Entity Framework assembly and add a reference in your project to it.
Okay,
so with that done, we can go ahead and start writing some code that interacts with Entity Framework. So the first thing to do is to write a context. And a context basically represents a session with the database. And I'm just going to resolve some references here. We want the system data entity namespace. You can see here this context is really simple. It derives from DB context, which is like the core class out of EF4.2. And I've exposed this thing called a DB set for the classes in my model. We just have one class, which is blog, so that's one DB set. And this represents the collection of blogs that exist in memory and in the database.
Right, so the context job is to manage the communication with the database once you specify where the database is, what the connection settings are.
That's correct, yeah. Yep.
It also serves like a launchpad for all your queries. So every time you write a query, you will use the properties on this context.
And it's in charge of entity tracking as well, things
yes.
like that.
Yeah. Okay, so now that we've got the context written, that's actually all we need to do to get up and running with a code-first app. So context is disposable, so I just wrap it in a using statement. And let's go ahead and add in a new blog. So I'm just going to pause here for a second to look at the API surface. For folks that have used object context, at this point you would be kind of visually assaulted with 60-odd different members showing up in IntelliSense that have to do with like database creation, some serialization things, really deep and complex functionality that's exposed in your face at the root level. What we've done with DB context is try to keep that really simple. So you'll see things are tucked away. So change tracking information, you drill into the change tracker property. If you want to do something with the database, you drill into the database property. And then all the simple operations like saving changes to the database are exposed at this root level. We're going to use our blog set. And again, on here, we've cleaned things up a bit. Almost all of the methods here are extension methods for link. The actual methods that are defined on a DB set are very minimal. So we're going to use the add method. So we'll add a new blog. I put my blog in there. Shameless plug. And then we'll just call save changes. Mm-hmm. So I'll go ahead and run this. Remember, we haven't specified anything about where our database is. We haven't told it what the database looks like or anything like that. Seems to have worked, though, so the data must have gone somewhere. CodeFirst has a set of conventions, and don't get scared. You can override all of these. If you don't like where the database is, you can tell CodeFirst where to put the database. If you don't like the table structure, you can tell CodeFirst what the table should look like. But I'm just going to refresh, and you'll see we've got a demo4.blogcontext database. Demo4.blogcontext is the assembly qualified name of our context. So that's part of the conventions that CodeFirst is using. If we look at the tables for that, we'll see that there's a blogs table. I'll just expand that out a bit and zoom in. And we'll see we had three properties on our class. So not surprisingly, CodeFirst has created three properties in the database.
So this has actually created a SQL Server database
running
on SQL Express or CE or...
So by default, we target SQL Express.
Okay.
So it will literally look for ./SQL Express on your machine. You can, of course, override that. You can plug in and say, I want you to target CE by default. Or you could say, I want you to target this SQL Server that I have sitting out somewhere in my organization and use that. And a little later, we'll see, you can actually say, don't create a database, target this existing database that I already have. Mm-hmm. The other thing you'll notice here is this EDM metadata table. This is a table that CodeFirst uses to store some additional information about your model. And we'll see in a second where this comes into play. This is something people often don't like. We're putting extra tables in their database, and you can actually take it out if you want. You literally can delete it straight from Management Studio here, or you can tweak the CodeFirst code to say, don't put this table in my database.
So demo4.blogcontext is the name of the database.
Correct.
Is that to make it less likely that the database already exists, or is this a new naming scheme for databases that we should think about adopting?
This is just to make sure there's no collisions. I can't imagine many people are going to go into production with a database called demo4.blogcontext. They're probably not going to roll a console.
It's just more readable than some GUID.
Yeah, it helps you identify which database was created for your context. So this is probably one of the first things people are going to change.
Yeah, like the default convention we wanted to be, okay, this is a database for this application. So we choose. Okay. An application could have multiple contexts, and, well, like the qualified name seemed to be a very good choice for that.
Yep. All right, so that's our first app up and running. Let's take a look at what happens if we try and change our model now. So we're going to go ahead and add in a new property. Let's say we're going to introduce a rating for blogs. I'm just going to go ahead and run the application. Remember, we have an existing database, so we're actually going to get an exception. I'll just zoom in a bit for folks there.
Okay.
So what this exception is telling us in quite a few words is that the database no longer matches our model. And this version of Entity Framework 4.2, CodeFirst is only capable of creating a database, not changing it over time.
Changing it over time is something that you can, well, are looking into introducing. I mean, adding a property, you can add a column, presumably.
Absolutely.
Depending on whether or not it supports nulls. I mean, there's additional work that needs to be done.
So there is. So this is where folks were saying CodeFirst is really good and it's useful. It's really good at the moment for prototyping and such. But if I'm actually going to have my code managing my database, I need to be able to tell the code how to evolve the database over time. So I'm going to add this rating property. It's not nullable, so I probably want to assign a default rating. I need to be able to control all that stuff as it happens. And this is where the migration solution comes in. So we're going to look at migrations in the next segment of this series,
okay,
I think.
So CodeFirst migration solves this.
Yeah, it gives us like a code base.
I don't want to call it a problem. This
I think it's a
feature.
Problem.
Or a problem.
I was going to be polite.
Yeah.
All right, this problem.
This problem, yeah. This is exactly what migrations is targeting at solving. So we have some betas of migrations out at the moment, so you can download those. We've iterated quite a bit. We've pretty much landed on the API surface we plan to ship. Mm-hmm. So you can get the beta, find it on our team blog, which we'll look at a little later on, and actually use it. Entity Framework 4.3 is going to have migrations in it, and then the RTM of that's not in the too distant future. You'll be able to actually use this in a fully supported release. Now, unfortunately, in EF 4.2, you can either manually edit your database yourself, or you can tell CodeFirst, I'm okay with you deleting the database and recreating it.
Right.
So let's just go ahead and look at what that looks like. So database.setInitializer. So I have the ability to register some logic that will run when CodeFirst initializes the database. And we're going to set the initializer for our blog context. We ship some initializers in the box, and one of those is the drop create database if model changes. which is generic on the context type. I'll just split that over two lines. It doesn't really show up on the screen there. Okay, so this is telling code first. When you get to the database, if it no longer matches the model, blow the database away and replace it again. Obviously not a viable option for deploying into production, but good if you're iterating locally. We run again. This time the database will be dropped and recreated. I'm just going to go over here and refresh the columns, and we'll see our new rating column has come up.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have a lot of time, so I'm not going to show a lot of the capabilities here, but let's just look at some ways we can influence the schema a little bit. First thing you might say is, I don't like my column being called blog ID. I want it to be blog underscore ID. My DBA says that's how primary key columns have to be named.
Okay.
So we can go ahead and add the column attribute, which is in the data annotations namespace. And I'm just going to say that the name for this column is blog underscore
ID. So in the database, it's blog underscore ID, but in my code, it's blog ID the way I want it.
Correct.
So you just you just do that mapping. So you don't have to adopt the DBA's requirements, but you can fulfill it.
Absolutely.
Click on making happy anyway.
Yes. Yeah. Everybody's happy now.
Okay. So just looking at what I've done there, I've put an attribute in my class. Now this kind of starts to violate POCO a little bit. If I'm polluting my class with attributes that talk about how it maps to the database, that's easy, but it's not necessarily very clean. I might want my classes to stay clean. So we give you another option too, which is a Fluent API. So I'm going to override this method called onModelCreating. And this gives me access to this model builder, which is like a configuration object I can use to tell EF how to map my classes to the database. And this is a Fluent API, and it's called Fluent because you sort of chain calls together and it reads in a semi-understandable English kind of way.
Mm-hmm.
So on the model builder, I'm going to call up the configuration for the entity that is blog. From there, I'm going to drill into one of the properties. And the property I want is say name. You can notice everything's strongly typed. We're making use of Lambda syntax there. And then there's a whole bunch of things I can configure here. So I'm just going to configure the column name as well. So my DBA might want this to be called blog underscore name.
Okay.
So this is just a way of changing the same things, but using Fluent API instead of annotations.
Yeah. So another way that I've seen this done is to create basically a partial class of the POCO and then put the attributes in a separate class.
You can do that as well, buddy class, okay. That's called. That's a buddy class,
right.
That is called. That will work. Most folks tend to start out with the attributes just because they're easier. The Fluent API is actually a bit more capable, so mm-hmm. There's some really complex things you can do. So Entity Framework, like we could take this blog class and we could say the data for this blog isn't stored in one table. It's stored in two or maybe even three tables. I can't do that with attributes. I have to use the Fluent API to say, here's blog and here's how it maps to these three different tables and how you aggregate the data and split it up when you save.
Right.
Okay. So let's just run this and make sure I'm telling the truth and it actually works. So it's run, I'll go and refresh the columns. And you can see we've got our two columns renamed, blog ID and blog name. There's a whole bunch of stuff you can configure. We could spend 2 hours just going through configuration options. I can change the data types, I can change the order of columns. Like I said, you can even change table names or map to multiple tables.
You can put simple validations in there, right?
Yeah. Actually, one of the changes you can make is change the max length of the name, for instance, to some fixed value.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do that, Entity Framework is going to validate on save that the instance of the class actually contains something that doesn't go over that max.
Okay.
So one thing I'll just call out on the attributes, just because this is interesting. So at the moment, this column attribute is actually defined in the Entity Framework assembly. In the next release of .NET, we're taking all these attributes and putting them into the System Component Model Data Annotations assembly. So that makes the whole purpose of data annotations is they're like reusable attributes that can be used by multiple different layers in the stack. So for example, required is honored by Entity Framework. It's also honored by MVC, for example.
Right.
All these attributes are going to be in the core .NET framework in the next release. So I think with that, we might jump over and perhaps show model first.
Sure.
Next. Is that all right? So again, just a simple console app. Call this one demo 5. So this time, I'm going to add a new item. And under the data menu, I have this ADO.NET entity data model. and we're going to call this blogging. It's going to be our blogging model. Here are the two options I have. I can generate from an existing database, and this is database first, and this would look at the existing database I have and generate like a starting point model for me. We're going to show model first, so I'm going to go with the empty model. Gives me a fresh design surface, so I can go ahead and add a new entity. So we want a blog entity. And let's give it a key property and call it blog ID, which is the same as what we used in our code first one. And then we can just go ahead and start editing this model. So I'm just going to add in a couple of properties. So we'll give it a name. And let's give it a URL too. Obviously, I can change. By default, these things are strings. You can see over here that URL is a string. I can tweak my model all I want. Once I've got that done, I can go ahead and generate the database from the model. So I tell it what database. We don't have a database yet, so we're going to go on our SQL Express. And we'll create a blogging database. It's going to say the database doesn't exist. You want me to create it? Sure, sounds good. We'll step through the rest of the designer. And here it's going to give me the SQL statements that will create my database. Right. I'll hit finish and it's going to open them up in the project. And from here, I'm just going to go ahead and execute them. All right, so that's completed. And if we look down through the script, we'll see there's like create table statements to create the database we want. All right, so with that done, we can actually now start writing code. Go ahead and new up our context, which is called blogging container. Now remember, we haven't got EF 4.2 in here yet. We're just using stuff that's in VS 2010. Okay. So when I hit DB, you're going to see the object context surface, which is going to bring up a lot more members than we saw with DB context. So let's look at using EF 4.2. So the first thing I need to do is actually get EF 4.2. So in Package Manager console, I'm just going to go ahead and run the install package command. Installing packages is on a per project basis. So the fact that I installed it before is only relevant to the project we were writing. Now that we have EF 4.2, we can go ahead and use the default or the customized code generation feature to install a new template, which is going to generate a DB context instead of our object context. So add code generation item, we'll do that. And if we look in online, we'll see that second one down is the C# DB context generator. So we're going to go ahead and add that.
And so this is with 4.2. So with the is that going to be part of 4.3 or future releases, or will you always need to go get that?
You'll always need to go get that. So we are looking at ways with NuGet, how can it integrate with stuff that's on Visual Studio Gallery. So installing the templates actually requires you to go through this add code generation item, look in the online gallery, and then grab them from there. What we might see in the future via NuGet is when you install the Entity Framework package, it's going to say, hey, do you also want to install this stuff off VS Gallery, and give you the option to drag that tooling in. Okay. So with that done, if we look at the code generation file that was there before, we see it's empty. But what it has added is these two templates. So we've got a context being generated here, and this is TT, which is T4. Which is a sort of code generation language. If we look at the code it's generating, we see a very simple context there. Looks very similar to what we wrote with code first. The one thing you'll notice here is it's telling it to load a particular connection string from the config file. So if we look in the config file, we'll see a blogging container connection string there. And that connection string is going to actually point it to the XML file that sits behind the designer. The other thing we get is another template here, which is generating our classes. And so we can see blog. Again, a very simple class, what we'd probably expect to write. And then if we come back to our code and hit IntelliSense, we see the DB context API and things.
So once you install that template, that generates your context for you, then you can use the DB context and the DB set.
Yeah.
Okay.
Did you want to talk about what we're doing with templates in the next release?
No.
Okay. We are looking at making this the default so that if more and more folks use the DB Context API, mm-hmm. then they'll actually get it by default. Yeah.
Okay. Hopefully we'll get to it, but I'm not completely sure at that point. Okay. At this point, so that's the reason I didn't want to talk about it.
All right, that's fair enough.
Sorry, I stomped on your
problem.
Very sensible decision there.
That's a great idea. You'll look into that, right?
We are looking into that. It's only a matter of time and resources.
Right.
Yeah.
Cool. So do you think we should show database first? Probably running a little bit short on time, but I can show it now if you want.
Sure.
Okay, let's fire up demo 6.
And then the code you'd write to add a new blog at this point is exactly the same.
Yeah,
as
like I said before, once you have your model, then everything's exactly the same.
Okay.
So we'll go with demo 6. So again, we're going to add a new item, and we're going to make it from the data tab an entity data model. We'll call this one blogging again. This time, we're going to use generate from a database.
Right.
And as a kind of cheat, I'm going to point it to that database that we just created with model first.
Sure.
It's an existing database that has some data in it. It's then going to give me the option of choosing which objects I want to bring in. Now, we only have a single table in the database, so I can check that. A few other options here, which we won't really go into, but I have the options to switch on and off pluralization. So it's going to see that I have a blog table. It's going to change it to be blogs. And I can choose whether to include foreign key columns for relationships or not. So I have foreign key columns in the database. I may or may not want those as actual properties in my object model. We recommend leaving them in. It makes things a lot simpler if you do.
You don't have to use them.
You don't have to use them.
You can just say order.orderDetail.
Exactly, yep.
Dot whatever.
Okay, so from here.
Or blog.post.
I've got my model.
I'm dating myself. I'm talking about orders and order details.
That's Norwind, right?
Exactly.
All right. So again, from here, I can just start using the code. It's all ready to go.
Mm-hmm.
By default, I get an object context. I might actually, while we're here, just take the opportunity to show you the code that gets generated by default. So if I look at the context, you can see there's like a lot of code in here. Right? I have constructors. I have these weird partial methods. I have object set properties that have quite a bit of logic in them. Like, this is way more complicated than the DB context template. This gets even more profound when I go and look at the classes that get generated. So let's go look at the blog class. This was like a 4-line class. Now, other one, you can see by the time we get down to here, we're down to 208 lines of code for this very simple model. So this is one of the great advantages of DB context. Like, people want to look at this code to help understand, help their mental model along a bit. This is really complicated. If I go ahead and add the DB context template now, then life gets a lot simpler.
So you can, at this point, add the DB context template and not have to use the object context.
Yep. So again, just add code generation item.
Okay.
Go to the online templates, get the C# one, hit add, and we're up and running with DB context now.
Great.
Did you install the runtime for?
Yes.
Okay.
All right. So one final thing I want to show, and I'm just going to show this really quickly. Let's go with demo 7. We've seen code first to a new database. We've seen model first to a new database. Database first from an existing database. The one thing we didn't look at was code first to an existing database.
Right.
So let's go ahead, and I'm just going to install EF4.2 in our project. All right, so we have EF4.2 now. I've downloaded from Extension Gallery something called the EF Power Tools. And this is a preview mode. It's still like a really early preview. One of the options it gives me, if I right-click on a C# or VB.NET project, is to go Entity Framework, Reverse Engineer Code First. I'm going to point it to my SQL Express. And actually, I lied there. It only works for C# at the moment. I'm going to point to our existing blogging database and hit OK. And what the Power Tools are going to do is look at the contents of that database and work out what the code first model would look like. So it saw there was a blog table. So it generated me a blog class. It's very simple,
okay.
Right? It generated me a context. It's done a couple of extra things in here. You can see that it's switching off the database initializer. This is just a fail-safe. So we don't want code first to be creating a database. If something happens and the database isn't there, we want an exception. So we switch off database initialization. We've also gone ahead and switched off the include metadata convention, which gets rid of that EDM metadata table out of the database. And then it's actually used in another feature where you can do fluent configuration inside the onModel creating method, or you can split your configuration up into separate classes. So it's done that. It's created this blog map class, which is a configuration object, which defines all the mapping for blog. You can see in here it's telling it how it maps to the columns.
Okay, so you started with the database,
mm-hmm.
and now you have code.
Yes.
So how is this code first?
It's code first in the sense that you are code-centric, and you care more about your code than having XML artifacts defining your mapping. Or
So it's essentially database first using Poco.
Code. So the other thing here, remember, yes? There's no XML file, so there's no designer. Okay. So instead of a designer, I have these files that tell me. So if I go ahead and make changes to my model, then I update these classes.
Yeah, actually, I want to be honest about the fact that when we picked the name Code First for this, we were not thinking about the importance of this scenario. We really thought, okay, Code First is about people that are going to start with code and are going to get the data out from the code. We learned very quickly that actually half of our customers were using Code First against existing databases. And then we realized, okay, well, Code First is just a name.
Right.
Doesn't mean much. It's just, okay, it's code-centric. It's all about like having all your mapping defined in code and not necessarily that you start always with code and you don't have a database.
Okay.
Yeah. Some people don't get over it, but we are trying.
This has been nicknamed quite often Code Second. But, you know, we'd already made the decision by that point, so.
It's a name.
I mean, it is.
It was just to understand what it does, and then we go from there.
So this is, like I said, this is very similar to database first. Have database, get a model, change it. It's just the model is code instead of an XML file.
Okay. So given that we're starting from a database, we then wind up in code, when would I choose this versus just relying on the code that database first generates for me? Does it matter when I get to actually doing the app?
It's totally up to you. So a lot of people aren't going to accept the default mapping. So by default, it's a one-to-one mapping between classes and database.
Okay.
Classes that get generated exactly align with the tables. When it comes time to change that, so say you want to change the name of a property, do you want to go into the designer and change the name in a box? Or do you want to come into code and let's just use an example here. Say we want to change name to be blog name. We can literally just do VS refactoring here. And everything works because my mapping file got updated that says that the blog name property maps to the column called name.
All right, I see.
So it's purely a style. Do I want to edit code or do I want to edit a designer?
Okay.
Yep.
Cool.
So I think that about wraps us up. That's a lot of data we just went over.
Okay, that's excellent. I think we'll stop here for part one, and then we'll do anything else we had thought of before we started in part two and anything else we think of between now and then.
Sounds good.
All right. Great. Thanks. Thanks for coming on, and thanks for watching, and we'll see you in part two. So see you next time on Visual Studio Toolbox.